It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegebright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
When you are filing your petition for your protective order, you need to make sure that you ask for in your petition all the things that you will need, because if your abuser has not gotten notice of the things that you're going to ask for, the judge may, in the full hearing, not hear those matters because the person you're opposing has not had the opportunity to defend against those things.
Palma Pastilnik, staff attorney at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Charlottesville office, explains how to handle your own petition for a protective order if you are not able to get representation by an attorney. And during this week's News You Can Use, we alert you about how to avoid Obamacare scams in the new health insurance marketplace. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 215, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Uncertainty about changes in the U.S. healthcare laws tied to Obamacare, also known as the Affordable Care Act, or ACA, are fueling scams that are likely to get worse, the National Consumer League's Fraud.org warned last month. The idea that consumers have to buy health insurance, that potential government penalties are looming, and that steps many don't understand are being taken by federal officials have opened the door to all sorts of crooks. Scams have been reported nationwide, some 1,100 related complaints filed with the Federal Trade Commission in May alone. Variations of the scams have surfaced in Massachusetts, which already has an established government-operated health insurance marketplace, Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, and Nevada. These scams are coming from virtually every means of communication, phone, fax, email, and even face-to-face. A common version of the scam involves fraudsters claiming to be from the federal government and directing consumers to purchase insurance cards in order to be eligible for coverage under the ACA. Scammers intimidate consumers to give them their bank account routing numbers or make a direct cash transfer by using words like, "It's the law," or "The government now requires it." Some of the scams are tied to telling targets they could face jail time for failing to comply. While that's a powerful message, it isn't true. The penalties connected to failing to have insurance are only financial. Other scammers falsely claim to be navigators helping people apply for coverage under the new law. Rather than navigate them through the new law, though, they end up leading victims to give up their personal information and pay money for phony insurance. Here are some tips to help avoid Obamacare scams. Learn about the actual rules and how the changes will affect consumers from the government. Government workers will not ask you to wire them money or give out your bank account number. Beware of unsolicited calls that ask for you to update personal information because it's the law. And avoid being directed to insurance marketplace sites. Rather, find them through official channels. If you give out information and later realize you've been scammed, tell your bank, credit card companies, and the credit reporting bureaus to help protect against fraud. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Charlottesville Office of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, and we're speaking with staff attorney Palma Pastelnik about how to handle your own petition for a protective order. Welcome back to the show, Palma.
Hi, Marty. Good to be here.
Now, one of the reasons we're doing this is because although legal aid does a lot of representation in protective order cases, we don't always have an attorney to provide one in every single case. And moreover, not every single person who is seeking a protective order is eligible for free legal aid, and yet they may be unable to afford private representation. So it's important for people to know how to handle their own protective order case. So let's start with the basic concept, Palma. What are the legal grounds for getting a protective order?
If we're talking about a family abuse protective order, the litigation for that would take place in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations District Court in your locality. That would be when the family abuse threat or violence has occurred between family members who are defined as either people married to each other, people who have a child in common, people who have lived together in a romantic relationship within the past 12 months, people who are a parent and child to each other, people who are siblings to each other, or in-laws who live in the same home. So your parents-in-law who live next door to you, that is not a situation where you can get a protective order. But if you live in your in-law's home, then the situation does apply.
Now, you just described the categories of people who could get a protective order for family abuse. I assume there's another type of protective order for non-family abuse. Could you describe that?
Yes, that is more commonly regarded as the dating protective order, although it's not restricted to that relationship. In fact, relationship does not define it. It's the same sort of abuse or threat or violence, but there does not have to be that familiar relationship between the parties. You could be merely dating without cohabiting, or you could be neighbors, or you could be strangers. In the past, you were required to also have brought criminal charges for the behavior that was bringing you to seek protection at the same time. And while that is no longer the case, the law changed about 2 years ago for that. Judges are still in general district court looking for behavior that rises to the level of a criminal complaint. And if you are not bringing a criminal complaint with your petition for a protective order, they are going to want to know really good reasons why not before they would grant one.
Now, you just mentioned the court, general district court. So am I to assume that you go to two different courts depending upon whether it's family abuse or whether it's non-family abuse?
Yes.
Okay. So lead us through the process. Choose whichever you want, or both for that matter. Someone is a victim of abuse as you have defined, and they need protection. What should they do?
Well, depending on how it first starts out, and I will speak about the family situation because there are a lot more moving parts in that one and a lot more things that people have to consider rather than just when it's relative strangers. A lot of times one of your alternatives is just leaving. And frequently when there are children in common or other familial ties, just leaving doesn't work. So that's the more complicated situation. So that's the one that I will address. The first thing that one should be aware is if you've got violence going on right now and you're either in danger because of what is happening to you or because of what you fear will happen to you, call 911, get the police to your home, and have that as an emergency order that the magistrate can issue if there is certain level of abuse or threat. And if the police are with you, the magistrate is more likely to issue it because they will speak to what has occurred. And that is good for up to 3 days or when the court is next open.
Now, a lot of times when the police arrive, both parties are, shall we say, getting into it. What are the police supposed to do in that situation? What are they required to do in that situation?
The police are now, in recent years, trained to identify what they call the primary aggressor. That doesn't necessarily mean the one who made the first hit. That means the one who is causing the most threat or damage. And so if in some circumstance, for example, the aggressive party in the relationship is coming at the other party and the weaker person has tried to defend themselves or deflect something and somehow managed to hit first, if the other person, the actual aggressor, has been coming at them with greater force or with greater threat, the police are trained now to identify that, and so they will protect that weaker party, in theory. That's the plan.
So let's assume you're not the primary aggressor. You're the person the police take down to the magistrate's office. You get that 72-hour protective order. First of all, when does it become effective and provide you protection? And then second, what's the next step in the process?
The emergency protective order is valid on its face when issued. A person who violates it, in other words, the person against whom you've taken it out, cannot be prosecuted for a violation until after they have been served. So when an emergency protective order is issued, if the police have not kept your aggressor in custody and been able to serve them with that emergency protective order right then, until they are served, anything they do is not prosecutable as a violation of protective order. It may be prosecutable as something else, but it's not prosecutable as violation of protective order.
And will the person who has been abused learn when the police or someone has been able to serve the abuser with that emergency protective order?
In Virginia, the magistrate's office and law enforcement contact the victim witness coordinators who work out of the local Commonwealth's attorney's offices, and those victim witness coordinators make contact with all people who have sought protective orders in their jurisdiction, and they are trained to inform people when service has been obtained and what other safety planning they might need to do.
Okay, so the order has been issued. Let's say it's been served. What's the next step for the abused person to do?
The next step for that abused person, or the first step for a person who hasn't needed to call the police in the middle of the night for an emergency, but who is nonetheless under force or threat or otherwise needs a protective order, would be to go to their local court services unit, which is usually either in or near their juvenile and domestic relations district court, and ask to petition for a preliminary protective order. This is a protective order that is good for up to 2 weeks. What generally happens is that the day you file your petition, you are heard ex parte. That means just you, not your abuser, by the judge, who will decide whether or not your facts warrant the issuance of this preliminary protective order, which protects you and anyone that you've indicated and given reason to the judge to believe is necessary to protect for health and safety purposes, such as your children or your elderly mother or someone else who might live with you, until a full hearing can be set.
So at that preliminary protective order hearing, what should the petitioner say, other than obviously the truth, but what should they say?
Well, let me back up, because even before that, when you are filing your petition for your protective order, you need to make sure that you ask for in your petition all the things that you will need, because if your abuser has not gotten notice of the things that you're going to ask for, the judge may, in the full hearing, not hear those matters because the person you're opposing has not had the opportunity to defend against those things. So when you're filing your preliminary protective order petition, if you need to ask for temporary custody of your children, if you need to ask that your children be included on the protective order because they're either in danger from the abuser or because the abuse that they've witnessed has been harmful to them and they need to be in your custody so they can get appropriate counseling. If you need temporary support, either child support, spousal support, or both. If you need the use of a family vehicle to be able to get to work or to take the children to school. If you need to make sure that your abuser does not have the ability to cut off utilities that are maybe in his name. If you need other relief, and there can be non-specified relief. If you need to have exclusive use and possession of the home which you've all been sharing, and you need the abuser to be excluded from that home, these are all things that you need to ask for in the petition that goes to the judge before you're heard by the judge ex parte, so that it's in the petition and can be seen by your abuser when he's served with that notice, so that when the full trial is heard, he can defend against that, because that's the whole constitutional notice and an opportunity to be heard piece.
Okay, so we're at the preliminary protection order hearing. It's ex parte. Only the person seeking protection is there. And let's assume that she has asked for most, if not all, of the list of things that you mentioned. Again, other than telling the truth, what should the petitioner be saying, as well as maybe what the petitioner shouldn't be saying?
Well, first of all, you need to be very, very short and to the point. Our courts are notoriously backlogged, and our judges are tremendously busy, and they don't want to hear and can't take the time to hear the five-year history of how you wound up wrestling over whatever that caused this altercation. You need to be specific about what exactly happened on the day that you either filed your petition or you got your emergency protective order that caused you to seek that protection at that time, whether it was you being strangled, and yes, I mean strangled. When somebody puts their hands around your throat, they are strangling you. Choking is something that happens when a hard candy goes down your throat wrong. Strangulation is now in the Virginia Code. It can be charged as a felony. So use the proper language. If you've been strangled, if you've been hit, if you've been stabbed, if you've been shoved against a wall, or if somebody's taking a brick and saying, I'm going to pound your head in, and starts pounding it on the wall next to you, that's a threat that caused you to fear for your safety. That is something that can be appropriate. Now, if what has happened is your abuser who has had a long history of abusing you, and now is the time when you finally are able to ask for help, says, well, you know, I'm going to bury you where nobody will find you, and I'm going to do what I did last time. You can tell the judge that. But then, yes, you do need to go back and say, you need to go back in time and say, and the reason I am so fearful is because what he did last time was this. And that is the only time when it's appropriate to delve into your past history. If part of the threat and part of your fear is due to him resurrecting past actions.
Okay, so let's assume now that you have gotten your preliminary protective order. It's good for 15 days. I assume that within that 15-day period, you'll have the hearing on the permanent protective order. Is that a good assumption?
Most of the time. Here are some things that could interfere with that. First of all, it could be much shorter than 15 days. It depends on what the opportunities for service on your assailant are and what the court's schedule is. Every once in a while, it could be a little more than 15 days if the court's not meeting again. But generally speaking, your hearing will be in a week to 2 weeks from the date you've gotten your preliminary protective order. What could happen if there are associated criminal charges is that your assailant may ask that the protective order hearing be postponed until on or after the criminal hearing takes place so that they are not at risk of incriminating themselves defending against the protective order before they have been tried for the criminal case. So in that case, your preliminary protective order would be continued until the permanent protective order is heard.
Okay, so you're now at finally the permanent protective order hearing, whether it was a week later, 2 weeks later, maybe even a month or more later.
Correct.
And let's assume that the assailant is in court. Again, what should the petitioner say and do? Is this just a rerun of what happened at the preliminary protective order, or is it a lot different?
If there were associated criminal charges and the criminal hearing has just concluded, the first thing you will want to do is ask the judge to move all the evidence from the criminal hearing into evidence for the protective order. And if that includes a conviction, all the better. But even if it doesn't include a conviction, you still want to do that because the burden for a criminal conviction is beyond a reasonable doubt. The burden for a protective order is merely a preponderance of the evidence. Preponderance means a hair over half. So evidence that is sufficient for a protective order may be insufficient for a conviction, just as evidence that didn't manage to make a conviction may be more than sufficient to merit a protective order. So that's your first step. If a criminal case is not involved, one of the things that you will need to remember is that your assailant or his attorney will have the opportunity to cross-examine you on your evidence, and they will also have the opportunity to present their evidence, and you will have the opportunity to cross-examine them. You don't ever have to look at them. You can look only at the judge. You should always listen very, very closely to any question they ask. Think about it carefully and formulate the shortest possible truthful answer that you can, because they can always ask a follow-up if it's necessary. You don't need to give them other information that might muddy the waters of your case.
And what about the questioning of the abuser? A lot of people just have no idea how to formulate a question. Do you have some suggestions there?
Well, when you are cross-examining him, the first thing is you can only go within the scope of what his testimony was. So if he doesn't talk at all about your dog, you can't question him about your dog. Perhaps if you raised something about your dog in your testimony, even if he doesn't go there, the judge might let you go there, but probably not. So that's one of the basic rules. Just like if he starts to ask you about something that you didn't testify about, you can object because he has to stay within the scope of your testimony. If you have heard him say anything in his testimony, you should be taking notes when he's testifying that you think is wrong or that you know that you have a way to refute or disprove, you should certainly call him on it. So, but always be very, very polite, be very, very short, and be very, very to the point. Because again, you need to get through this as quickly as possible.
And any other suggestions for people when they are at that permanent protective order hearing in front of the judge, asking for protection for up to 2 years?
Any evidence that you can bring that will establish the need for any of the things that you've asked for in your petition, such as your lease showing how much the rent is, which might demonstrate need for an appropriate amount of support. If there's a vehicle and you have title to it, you should bring that. If there are people who've witnessed any of this behavior, you should certainly bring witnesses, because the more people who can say, yes, that person has a habit and a pattern of abusing this person, or on that particular day, I saw him punch her. That person should be at the trial with you. If you have medical records, bring them. If you can get the police report, if the police were involved, get it. And when the event occurs, if there are any marks on you that day or the next day, have somebody, if the police haven't taken pictures of them, have somebody else take pictures of them and identify them as when and where and what they are.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Staff Attorney Palma Pistolnik at the Charlottesville Office of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society about how to handle your own petition for a protective order. Thank you so much for being on the show, Palma.
Thanks, Marty.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. How do you know if you have a good case to obtain Social Security or SSI disability benefits? Join us next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when disability attorney Charles Crumbine reveals what succeeds and what doesn't succeed in a claim for disability benefits from the Social Security Administration. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wickwright.